Everyone can hear me? All right. My name is Parmita Mehta. I'm a program manager in the Azure Machine Learning team, and I'm here to tell you a little bit more about Azure Machine Learning. So before I start, there were two other sessions that we've had in TechEd so far on machine learning. Both of them were on Tuesday, and I kind of wanted to get a sense of, they covered a lot of preliminary material, so I just don't want to repeat myself and wanted to get a sense of how many of you had attended either or both sessions. Could you please raise your hands? Okay. So this is, I'm going to change. About 50% people have attended those sessions, so what I'm going to do is do a really quick overview and then go into the deeper how to build a model and everything. Please interrupt and ask questions at any moment. If I just did the presentation material, it's about 45 minutes, but I did that on purpose, so we have lots of time for questions and answers. All right, let's get started. So what is machine learning? Machine learning is really about looking at data and finding patterns. And often it's patterns that we as human beings cannot detect easily. Before we had machine learning, we had rules-based learning. You would take a bunch of data and you'd be able to figure out, oh, if this is so, if A is greater than X, then we need to check the value of Y, and Y is greater than C, then this is how I decide if the value is 100 or 1,000 or something like that. You basically had rules that you would evaluate one at a time and come upon a decision. Machine learning also sort of does that, but it detects patterns that are in such high dimensional space that we cannot interpret them. As soon as you go to 10 dimensions, it sort of starts becoming really, really hard to imagine what that looks like. So machine learning is really about detecting patterns in data, and in the age of big data, it is the critical process for making sense of this large amount of data. I'm going to step down here. These are a lot of examples, some examples here of how people are using machine learning today. So I want to briefly go over some of these, and almost all of you would have experienced them as a consumer, if not as a programmer or a data scientist. Churn analysis, that's something that almost every retail site that actually has consumers or any other retail business does. It tries to figure out how soon people are leaving the site without purchasing and how often they're losing people. And look at, in a retail website, it's really easy to follow their click stream and kind of make a decision about why is it that they're not coming back or doing something else. Also, previous purchases, other transactions can be used by brick and mortar stores to actually go and do this, but this is more prevalent in the retail consumer online business. I'm not going to talk about social network analysis, that's been done to death. Recommendation engines. You like this, so you might like this, because other users like you, who liked A and you liked A, like B. So basically, based on your preferences shown, it tries to map your user identity, which is mostly demographic information that they have, to other users like you, and then based on that information, they will suggest things to you. That's basically how a recommendation engine works. Anyone who's gone to Netflix knows that they'll suggest a whole bunch of movies. Not all of them are good, but some of them are actually pretty good, because the more data you have here, it does a better job of recommending things that might be suitable for you. That's also a machine learning algorithm. Equipment monitoring is another one that's actually pretty useful and is starting to gain a lot more traction than it had previously. So in equipment monitoring, you have lots of equipment which has a bunch of sensors. Elevators have lots of sensors. You have sensors on computers. You have sensors on any manufacturing unit that is built out, and it gives data on temperature. So let's just take a computer. It'll give you information on its temperature, its CPU usage, its hard disk number of IOs. It'll give information to you on exactly what's happening in the software. So it gives you hardware-based information, which is sensor-based, and it'll also give you software-based information on top of that. It's like, how often is this being, how hot is the machine running in terms of CPU, in terms of memory? And based on that, you can detect, is it faulting very often? Are there problems in the accessing of the disk? So you can use those sort of things to figure out, is this behavior within the ranges of normal behavior, or is it anomalous? And when you start detecting behavior that's outside of the normal ranges of good, you start saying, oh, this machine might go into failure in X amount of time. And the more data you have here on failure, the better you actually do. But usually, you just have this boundary of good behavior of a particular equipment that you use to determine if the behavior is anomalous or not, and use that to detect or to tell if this particular machine is going to go into failure. We have a case study that was published on our site on elevator systems that you can actually monitor the sensor information that's coming back from these elevators. And based on that information, you can say, it seems like elevator X in this building is giving out numbers that seems like it might need to be tuned up or might have a failure in X amount of time if it's not looked at. And you can send someone in for predictive maintenance on that elevator, thereby not getting into a situation where you have a massive outage or something else that follows from there. Fraud detection. Given lots and lots of transactions, I can figure out which ones are fraudulent or look fraudulent. Now, with all of these, as we'll talk later, machine learning does give you an answer, yes or no, or multi-class answer, A, B, C, red, blue, green, or even a number, what your insurance premium should be. But usually what happens is it also gives you a probability of how probable it thinks that particular number is right. And we'll look into that, and depending upon your threshold, you can play with, depending upon your risk threshold, and we'll get into that a little bit, you can change how you react to that. So not only does it give you an answer, it also gives you a probability of how good it thinks that answer is. And we'll get into that. And this is something that's interesting. Are there any other cases or questions around how machine learning can be used? Okay. This is an animated slide, but I am going to skip the animation. All right. So this is really a layer cake of how the machine learning solution in Azure ML works. I'm directly jumping into what it is that we do today. As a count, how many of you have actually tried out the Azure Machine Learning service? Okay, great. So you start here at the leftmost, left bottom corner, and even though we call it the Azure Ops team, this is the operations team at the customer site that is managing your Azure subscription. If you are the only one using it, you are the data scientist and you are the ops team, which is the users in both of these boxes. But in most cases, in large companies, the team that actually manages the Azure subscription is going to be a different one. So, and I'll show you how this works out. The Azure Ops team will go, they're the ones usually in large enterprises that they have the key to the Azure subscription, and they will create what we call a workspace for you. This is the sandbox where data scientists can go and play and create their own models and everything, but they need to do this. So they go create a workspace here. After they have created the workspace, they get an email notification sent to the data scientist saying, here's a link to your workspace, now you can go and play in this. So that's why we have this piece, and I'll show you how this looks when we go to the Azure portal in a second. Once you are in this workspace or sandbox, this environment is called Machine Learning Studio. This is your IDE for building your machine learning models, for looking and working on the data, for creating the web services going forward. But this is basically your sandbox. As a data scientist, you can do whatever you need to here to work with the data. So what do you usually do? The first thing you do is you import data, right? Before you can build a model, you need the data. We support a lot of different data sources in the cloud, anywhere in HTTP, as well as your desktop. You can upload that data, and I'll show you how we do that. Once you've uploaded the data, you have a bunch of algorithms and modules in there, as well as the ability to bring in your own R code that allows you to now play with this data, transform it, look at it, and create a model. Then you test the model, see how good the predictive performance of the model is. Once you're happy with that, you've played around it, tried different things, you put that model into production or operationalize it by it's not put into production yet. You create a web service from it. Normally, what would happen is a data scientist would work on a model, Octave, MATLAB, R, Python, whatever it is that they use to build this model. They would build this model and it's perfect. Now they go to a developer and say, okay, I built this model. Can you please put it into a production for me? Because I need this model to be a part of my business logic that is actually checking certain things. For example, I built a fraud detection system. I need the transactions to go through that, or I'm building a model that detects, that'll predict what the premium should be for this particular person who's trying to get an insurance with this company. So now model is ready, please put it into production. They would take this code and try, because they are a developer and they work in Java or C# or C, they would try to move that into a different language. That is what made it so hard to operationalize this model, because they're doing this translation from one language to the other, and they are not data scientists. They don't even have access to the same libraries sometimes. So they're doing this because R is not very scalable, and you usually don't write production three-tier web services in those languages. This translation, as you can guess, takes several months and sometimes years to get them in place. Now you have them ready, they're tested, they're fault tolerant, they can fail over, they have disaster recovery capabilities, and you put them in production, and then you have new data and you need to update the model. So you go through this process all over again. Now what this allows you to do is the data scientist has created this model, and we will put this into production for as a web service for you. So when this is put in as into production as a web service, and I'll talk about the staging versus production, which is the handoff here, you get to put it in staging where you can test it, verify it's working, and that is something that the data scientists can do. They hand it over to the ops team, who actually puts it into production, and it's the same service. All they're doing is now they're getting an SLA endpoint rather than a throttled endpoint, which they get in staging. And they can get this endpoint to the developer, who now knows how to work with an HTTP REST web service endpoint. They can now write their code, and they can have the clickstream data or the mobile data or whatever other data sources. They can send it to this particular API service that was built using this model. And with the results of this, they can populate a dashboard or Power BI or whatever else they need to do to actually predict or show the results of these predictions. What we've done is we've empowered the data scientists to be able to put this in production as of service much easily and without needing the developer to do this translation between languages. So, questions on this. This, in both of the previous talks, I was not sure that this point kind of made it through, so I just want to pause here for a second and make sure you guys understand what I'm talking about, putting a model into production or putting a model up as a web service. And I'll show you how to do this. Okay. This has a lot more detail on it, which is sort of talks to all the things that I said. These slides will probably be available to you guys, so this is a reference slide for you later. And now we go, most of my talk is going to be spent on actually building a model and working through it. So think about it. There's three pieces to building a machine learning model the way we see it, or the way, the life cycle that the way I see it. First thing is you import data. You need data. you figure out how to import it. If you ask any data scientist, they will tell you that they spent a large portion of their time bringing data in, cleaning it, transforming it, visualizing it, getting other data sources in, cleaning them, joining them together. A large part of their job is really this data wrangling to get it into a format so that they can build a model on top of it. So importing and working with the data is the first part. Second part is once you've got the data, now you start experimenting with the various algorithms, or learners as we call them. Do you want to use a neural network? Do you want to use a decision tree? Is perceptron going to be enough? Do you want to use a SVM? Is it an ensemble model? Is it a single model? What kind of model do I use here? So you build a model, you compare the evaluative predictive performance of the models that you're building, you pick one that you like, and after you've picked one, you save off the model, and you put that particular model into production. So it's really three steps. But if you think about it, it's really a cycle. Once you have the model published as an API, you're getting new data. You want to keep improving your model, right? So what you do is, as you get new data, you again go back from here, you bring that data in, you rebuild that model, and you publish it again. And we allow you to do that with ease. Questions on this life cycle, because the rest of my presentation is in this ML Studio.
Just wondering, with regards to, there's quite a lot of choice, as in, like you say, which type you want to use. Mm-hmm. Is there any, I don't know, sort of, depending on, is it something that you learn after a while, which best fits which sort of data?
So the question is, there are lots of learners in there. How do I pick which learner to use to build my model? Is that right? So it depends on your data, it depends on the use case, and as you build these models enough, you'll figure out which works better for your data. That's based on the results, and I'll actually give you a little bit of a trick that I have in my head that I use to figure out which work better for what kind of data and what I'm trying to do here, and we'll go from there. Anything else?
Knowledge that, like knowledge base, or they are statistical models most of the time?
No, they're not statistical models most of the time. Neural networks, for instance, are not statistical models, right? So we have a combination. Logistic regression, maybe you can call it a statistical model. Neural networks, no, right? So we have a combination of both. Okay. Remember, I talked about the Azure portal. This is the old Azure portal. I'm not machine learning is not yet available on the new Azure portal. If you guys have seen that, excuse me. In here, this beaker shape thing, this is machine learning. And if you need to go create, it's under data services, machine learning, quick create. What does a quick create do? It creates a workspace. That's all it does. You need to give it a workspace name. You need to give the live ID or the email of the owner. Right now, we only have this in South Central US. You can also give it a storage container, or you can ask it to create a new dedicated storage container for you if you need it. So that's what you do. That's how you create a workspace. I have two workspaces here. Both of them are for the same user, but I'm just using them separately. So this is how you do it. Once you are in here, you can sign in right here from here. Remember I told you ML Studio, Machine Learning Studio? This is a browser-based IDE or development environment or your sandbox where you get to build models. And we'll spend a lot of time in this. You can also add other users to it. And once you have this, remember that two box at the bottom where I said once your staging web service is done, you push it back to the IT admin to say, please go put it in production, and they get the SLA endpoint. So the third bullet here is the one when you're ready to say, okay, my staging web service is done with the testing and I'm happy with the results, put it in production. This is where they go and do that. And I can see the web services that are in here. I've built one, and you get basically the compute prediction failed, all the metrics and monitoring are available for the web services that are in production here. Okay. This is where I'm going to spend most of my time today. This is the Azure Machine Learning Studio. The URL is studio.azureml.net, and you can the live ID that we used to create the workspace. Once you type in studio.azureml.net, it'll ask you to sign in, and if you give it the live ID that was used to create the account for, remember in the portal previously, you sign into this environment. This is what you get. So we have, at a high level, four tabs. This is the home, and all this is really a combination of user guides, feedback, asking questions, forums, lots of video tutorials, sample applications, building block reference, and additional resources. So this is really a collection of useful links for you to go in and explore experiments. Now, this is an interesting part. We call everything in Azure ML Studio is an experiment. Remember, like in Word, everything is a doc. Even if you have to check the spelling of a word, you have to open a doc and type it in. Even if you have to just look at a data set, you have to start a new experiment. Everything is an experiment. You start the experiment, this is where you work with things. So this is an interesting question I get all the time. So when you click on this, you get all these experiments. How do I delete an experiment? I have too many of them. The only place you can delete experiments is if you go to all. This is where you get these check boxes and you get the delete button. Otherwise, you see your recent experiments, last edited, last run, last published, and there's a bunch of samples that we have there built in, so you can take a look at these as well. Second thing, data set. Although it is called data set, what this is really is a way for uploading information from your local machine up to the studio. So you can upload any file from your local machine up here as long as it is a data file or it can be R code. And I'll talk about the R code piece in a little bit, but it can be a CSV, a tab separated file, a plain text file, and there's other formats that are supported. Zip file, usually if you have a whole bunch of R files that you want to include, like kind of like a reference library, I usually zip them up. I have all my reference functions in a set of R files that I zip up in a single zip, and I have uploaded that and used that as if I was using a library because I can then reference those from within. Yes?
Excuse me, aren't JSON documents supported or XML documents?
Yes, you can import them. We don't have a native parser for them. We will be providing that, but if you can use R to parse them pretty easily. So you could import them and use R to parse them out. We will not natively parse them right now because we don't support that, but that's coming. That's in the works. We have to support that. We're working on that. Does that answer your question? So the question was, are JSON or XML documents natively supported? Not natively right now. You can import them as files, and you can write some code in R to parse them out into a data set, and we'll work with that. It's really simple code. If you want, I can write it up and put it up in Git or something for you guys to look at. Okay. So let's start. I'm going to start with a very simple experiment. This is what you get when you start an experiment. You get this three-part pane. On the left, you have a bunch of modules. The center pane is a canvas, and the right is a properties pane. We have about 160 or 170 modules that we provide, as well as a large number of data sets that you are provided by default for you. I have seen people trying to do this, like find the actual module that they're working with. I recommend search. Please don't try to find this because after a while you'll actually get lost. There's just so many of them and you don't remember. Is a writer in data transformation or data input? So again, it's up to you, but you'll find me using search a lot here. For those of you who've attended the previous two sections, please you can take a little break while I use the same example here to illustrate exactly what this does. So what do we have here? I typed adult, and what it showed me is the saved data set called adult census income binary classification data set. This is a data set that is publicly available from UC, University of California, Irvine data set repository. And all this is really a bunch of demographic information collected by the US Census folks. So when you have this module here, you dragged it in onto the canvas, you see this pin or this port, you can visualize that and all, because I triple clicked it, it downloaded it because that was a default action. But can you see this data? This is about 32,000 rows, 15 columns, and you have a variety of different attributes here. These are all demographic information on a person, and income is the last one. So for the purposes of this particular experiment, we will use all of these other pieces of information to predict this. So when you build a machine learning model, you have a whole bunch of data. You gotta tell it, what is the target column? Which column are you trying to predict, right? That's often called the class or the target column. And machine learning is interesting that you can give it a large amount of data set and it'll try to see if there is a way of predicting any column given the rest of the information. Usually there is a very specific piece of information that you don't have or you're looking for which you're building the model. And in this case, it is income. But I could do interesting things here, like keep the income in here and try to predict the age or something like that. For this experiment, however, we'll try and predict the income. So income is two classes. Less than equal to 50K and greater than 50K. So I have two classes. It does not give me an actual number. It just gives me a bucket for the information here. So first thing when you build a machine learning model is you want to take the data set and you want to split it into test and training. You build a model with the training data set and you test it with the test data set because you sort of want to see how it does with the training data set also. But when it builds this model, it is creating this relationship between these various features or various columns you had in the data set, and you want to see how it does on data that it's never seen before, which is the primary reason for having a test and a training data set separation. Sometimes you want to actually see how it did on the training data set also, because you don't want it to be overfitting your data to the data that it was trained on. That can be a problem. You want your machine learning models to generalize really well because you want them to be able to predict good values or values within a certain error condition for data it's never seen before, so that you can actually trust that value. So split does exactly that. What I'm going to do here is I'm just going to split rows. I'm just going to do 80% of my data is in training, which is the first pin, and 20% is in test, which is the second pin. You don't do a very good job here, but what we're doing is when I specify a fraction, that fraction is going to be available on the first pin. Then there are three modules that you always need when you're building a model. You train a model, you score a model, and then you evaluate a model. So and roughly, you think about it, you take the test data to get a trained model. The result of this trained model goes to the score model, and you compare it with the test data, the training data goes to trained model, and the result of the trained model module, which produces a trained model, will go to the score model. Score model takes the trained model from this particular module and the test data to score that. And when I say score, it's going to say, given this demographic data, this was what the module produced, and this is what the answer was in the test data set. And what evaluate does is then it takes that data and it makes some summary statistics on top of it, so you can figure out using those stats how good the evaluative performance of your model is, right? Now let's go to the point of what learners to choose. Learners are the algorithms that are used to build a model. I hate it when it expands all of them. Okay, so there is this thing called machine learning right here. And under it, there's core, train, and evaluate, but there is this thing called initialized model. This is where all the learners are sitting. So you can go and explore this section. This is where all the learners are sitting. Remember I said I'll tell you a little bit of about algorithms here? So you have classification, clustering, and regression. These are the three classes of learners that we provide today. Classification is the kind of problem that we are working on right now. I have a bunch of data, and I need to determine based on this data if the result falls in class A or class B, which is binary classification or two-class classification, or in case of I want to figure out if the answer is going to be red, green, or blue, that is a multi-class classification. You could have many more than red, blue, or green, but that's a multi-class classification problem. So classification will have multi-class and binary classification. Last is regression. Regression is when the variable that you're trying to predict is not a categorical or a factor variable. Categorical is I can put it in buckets. They're categories. A continuous variable is a number, someone's age, someone's insurance premium. So that becomes a regression problem. So all the algorithms that you want to, that are provided to detect or provide a continuous variable value would sit under regression. And clustering really is, okay, let me take a step back. We have supervised machine learning models and unsupervised machine learning models. Supervised machine learning models are where you have the answer, so you try to learn the pattern given the answer. In our case, we know what the income is for the training data set, and we're trying to learn based on that what the correlation is. Is there a pattern? If the answer is X, the pattern seems to be this, and with more and more of examples, our pattern becomes more and more accurate, hopefully. In unsupervised cases, you don't have an answer. People bought this. What are they likely to buy? You look at their basket and say, other people who bought A, B, and C are likely to buy D. Is that the right answer? No, not really, but you can create clusters here based on nearest neighbor, or are they close together, or do they happen together? So that's what clustering really is, an unsupervised method where you're taking a lot of data and trying to see if there are similarities or clusters of values that happen together. And in places where you don't have answers, that become useful. Okay. Can you see these? These are all the classification learners that are built in here. And I'm going to use a two-class logistic regression. Now in here, I have some parameters. These are, the default values are pretty good, but this is where you go if you want to go and tune these values better, depending upon what you're trying to do. Training model, anytime a model does not have a value, it's going to show you this red point saying there's a value required. And of course, I haven't told it what value I'm trying to predict, what my target column is. Remember the data set I showed you, I said it had 15 columns, and the last column was the income column, and that's a column I'm trying to predict. So I give it the index of the column that I'm trying to predict. And now I just hit run. So what is it doing right now? So I kind of showed you how to build this. I also showed you how I attached the algorithm to it and how I told you that what it's building, what it's trying to predict to the training model. Now it's trying to train on that. And it gets queued we have a bunch of backend nodes, and each of these gets sent to the backend nodes to be run. As they get, first it's queued, and you'll see the status when it's got this clock thing. It means it's waiting, it's queued, it's not running yet. When it's running, you get that green intermittent dot. Hopefully, evaluate model will show you that. It didn't, it just skipped it. But once it's done running, it'll show a green check. So on the evaluate model, I did visualize. Let me take you a step back first. So let's take a look at the score model. The result of the score model is all of the features or the columns that were sent to the model plus income plus two other variables called score label and score probabilities. The score label is the answer. And probability, I told you that it will give you a probability what the number is. Now, what it's doing here is it's a binary classification, so it's not going to give you 0 or 1. It's actually giving you a number between 0 and 1. And we're using a threshold of 0.5. If anything is less than 0.5, take it to 0. If it's greater than 0.5, take it to 1. I'll show you how we can change the threshold, but by default, it assumes a threshold of 0.5. And using that threshold on these probabilities is going to determine what the score label is. So 0.2 is less than equal to 50K, as is this number. Let's see if we can find a larger one. Anyway, so that's what it's doing. Now, evaluate model, what it does is it combines all of these and it builds some summary statistics on top of the results. The thing to note here is this particular thing, which is called the confusion matrix. Now, we said binary classification, so the answer is 0 or 1. In this, the answer really is less than equal to 50K and more than 50K. Assume that they are mapped to 0 and 1, which is what it's going to do. Less than equal to 50K is 0, more than 50K is 1. And now it has two classes. So true positive means the answer was 1 and it got 1. True negative was answer was 0 and it got 0. False negative is the answer was 1 but it guessed 0. Similar for false positive. It guessed 1 but the answer really was 0. So this kind of gives you the distribution of all the, remember the 20% of the things that we never gave to our model when we were building it, the test data set. This is used out of the test data set, and it's comparing them against the actual labels to come up with these statistics. Accuracy is really the ratio of true positive plus true negative over the total sum of the scored labels, right? 20%, I don't remember what the number here is, but it's 890 plus 4219 divided by all four of these. So how many of the answers did it get right? And then it has other things which measure how many of the right answers it got right, how many of the false answers it got right. Sometimes accuracy is not the best measure of the performance of your module. Say you have a case where your data set is 90% positive. You know the answer of 90% of the time is positive. In fraud detection, 90% of the transactions are good. Now, if you're using accuracy as a measure, a simple model that always returns yes is going to give you 90% accuracy. Is that a good model? Of course not. What you want to find is accurately when there is a fraudulent transaction, you want to be able to detect it. So just looking at accuracy is usually not the best policy, depending upon what you're doing, but it works. There are other cases where you might want to optimize for things like false positives or false negatives, especially in things like disease prediction. If someone doesn't have cancer, you don't want to give them a false positive. So a false positive is really, really bad in some cases, and so is false negative. It depends on what your model is trying to do, and then you can look at these numbers. So we give you all of these numbers and don't tell you exactly what the right answer is, so you can determine based on your model and based on what you're trying to predict what is the best thing for you. Now, the other thing I said was, remember the score label and the score probability. We just picked a threshold of 0.5. This is where you can change this. Say I want to be conservative, and my threshold, I want my threshold to be a little more than 0.8. You saw how the accuracy numbers changed? Because now more of the numbers that were actually deemed positive went to negative, right? So if you want to be more conservative or less conservative, and you can determine where your threshold is, and you can do a lot of these things to determine how well your model is doing. Is anyone familiar with the rock curve? Do you guys know what rock curves are? Do you want? Okay, maybe two people know, so I'm going to give an explanation here. ROC curve, or rock curve, is a visual way of looking at the evaluative performance of your model. If I just had a model that flipped a coin 50% of the time positive, 50% of the time negative, I would get this diagonal line right here. You see this line right here? This line? That is a line that corresponds to a completely random model that gives 50% positive, 50% negative. And if it's a perfect model, my line would look kind of like it'll go all the way up and all the way down. Right. So the area under the curve for a perfect model would be 1, and area under the curve for a random model would be 0.5. So this thing, AUC, which is the area under the curve here, is what you want to see. Overall, varying the thresholds, what does the area under the curve look like? A better model obviously has larger area under the curve, but I start to worry when the area under the curve is very high, because it means that my model is overfitted. Almost always means that my model is overfitted to the training data. And I want my model to not work perfectly for my training test data, but also work well for something else. So I need to be a little cautious when I start to get really high accuracy numbers or really high AUC. Like, am I overfitting here? Is there a variable in my feature set that's a very good proxy for the column that I'm trying to predict? Maybe I should take that out, because that's leading me to get really good answers here, and maybe that is not a column I always have populated in the incoming values. So this is where the art bit of data science comes in. You need to do a little bit of looking at the data that you have. Any questions before I jump into a more complex model? Okay. So we're going to build an interesting model today. We are going to build a sentiment analysis model. What I have is, I need, anytime I'm building a model, I need a labeled data set, because I need something that I'm going to train on, right? So this is a public data set that is available for Twitter feeds, for which is labeled positive or negative. And Sentiment 140, this is available from a Stanford site. Again, it's only for academic use. It can be used for commercial use, but this, what it does is it looks at the Twitter feed itself, the text of the Twitter feeds, and it labels it positive or negative based on the emoticons used, which is an interesting way of doing things, and I found it to be pretty good, but it's obviously there are multiple ways of doing this, and sentiment analysis is not a simple calculation. I'm just showing this here. Please don't use this in production, but all the warnings. So what does this data look like? This is what the data looks like. I have first row, which is the label, 0 in place of a negative emotion, negative sentiment, and I don't know if I'd, well, it's stratified, but 4 in case of a positive sentiment. There is Twitter ID, the date, the handle of the person who actually posted this feed, and the real text. So this has about 1.6 million tweets that are in this data set. Let me show you a couple other ways that, so I just uploaded this data set because it was easy enough, it was not very big. But I could have used a reader module, and in a reader module I can pick an HTTP source, or Azure Blob Store, or Hive Query, or Power Query, or SQL, any of these sources, and I can provide a URL in a data format, and it will pull the data in directly from there, so I don't have to download it and then push it up. It becomes a one-step process. It depends on what you're doing. And this works really, really well for most time, most part. I just happen to have this imported because I've run this before, so it's local in here, and I'm just going to use this one. So let's take a look at the data. That's the first thing you always want to do. Look, it didn't have column headings, so it took the first column, the first row, and used that as heading. So I want to change that. How do I do that? Obviously, you won't know this, so you see these and you see the videos, and I'll show you where the help is, so you'll figure out which module to use when. But there is a module called Metadata Editor, and you can use that to change the types. So by default, you'll see that it assigns types to the various columns, right? Numeric, string, and the third type, native type, is Boolean. You want to change the types, you can do that. But by default, it assigns types, and this is the place where you can go and change the data type if you want, or you can decide, tell them, this is a feature and this is a label. Feature and label is a very specific to machine learning sort of thing. Feature is the independent variables used to predict, and label is the variable you're trying to predict, right? Label is usually one column that you're trying to predict. It might have multiple values, but it's a single column that you're trying to predict. So there'll be one label usually, and the others will be features. Features are really, in this case, all the columns we have. You might want to change them or not, but this is a typical language you'll see. Attributes, independent variables, features, whatever you want to call them. All right, so I want to change. I'm going to give it, I want to give columns names, right? So these are the names, new names for each of the columns. And I want to say begin with all columns and take this away. Yes, I'm not changing any of this. I'm just going to give this name. So the metadata editor function does multiple things. In this case, I'm just using it to edit or give the names to the columns. So I have a little bit of a better idea what I'm working with here. And this is typically how I build an experiment. I never usually build out the whole DAG, the whole graph, and run. I usually add a module, run, look at the results, go back, change something, and run. So this is sort of the process, which is why it's called an experiment, I guess. But when you're actually working with this, I think this is the way most people would work. If not, I'd like to hear how else you work with us. Okay, this is taking longer than I expected. Questions while it's running? Okay. The other thing is, in here, you saw that there's a lot of different columns here. What I really need is a text, right? Because I'm going to use a text to determine what the sentiment is, and this is the label that's already provided. So although these other columns might be useful in some other time, I'm just going to take them out because I'm not using them right now. And this is taking a long time. So I'll start another experiment in a different window. Let's see how that works. And this time, since I know exactly what I want with the metadata editor, I'm just going to combine it, put the values in here. Next step I want to take is, remember I said I wanted to take out some of the columns? There's a module called Project Columns. This is a very SQL term. Many people get confused by what the heck is project? What do you mean by project? All I'm doing is I'm taking columns out here. Why is this? Okay. So here I say begin with no columns and include column one. Remember, column one was the sentiment, and not column name, column index one, in column index 6, I believe it was. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that's right. Once I run it, it actually knows the schema, so the names piece gets populated. You might have seen some of the demos that when they drop down and run things, you can use the column names and it populates the names, but you need to run it once so that the metadata and the schema gets populated and the experiment knows what exactly it's looking at. Because I haven't run that, the names will not be populated for me. Okay, so we've projected out the columns. Now, let me show you how I would run. Usually when I'm working with text, I want to clean up my text. There's a lot of text in here, and I'm going to do some other things where I'm building features out of that text. So I want to turn all of my text into lowercase, and I want to remove all everything that's not an alphabet or a number. So any alphanumeric characters, I want to remove. Any characters that are not alphanumeric, I want to remove them. So I have this script here, and I'll show you how exactly this works. But I drag and drop and execute R module, and in here, the properties pane, I can paste in this script. Now what is it doing? It's taking the input port, this is what I would combine it to, so now it's passing the results of the project column to the execute R script. And what it's going to do is it's going to take the port, MAML is Microsoft Azure Machine Learning. Map input port 1, which is the first port I mapped here, to a variable called dataset. Then saying the dataset first column, because now it only has two columns. Remember, I projected out everything with the first two, with the first column and the last column, so now it should only have two columns. First one is sentiment label, and second one is the tweet text. And in the tweet text, I'm using GSub with a very simple regular expression that says if it's not a number or an alphabet, just take everything out, replace it with a null character, and ignore case. So, and then I'm going to take the tweet text and turn it to lowercase. Then I'm going to combine tweet text and the sentiment label into a single data set. I'm using cbind, columbind, adding those two columns together, and then I'm mapping it back to the output port. So this is what my script is doing. Execute R, by the way, actually has two ports where you can put data in. This is where if I had my R, my zip file with a lot of R functions that I told you about, that sometimes I have a lot of reference R functions that I want to connect to, I can connect to here, and then I can just call those functions directly as if they were native functions. It has two ports, output ports. One is the resultant data set, which is here, and the second one is any R. So if I have any intermediate R output, I'm trying to visualize thing, I'm going to plot a graph, all of that goes to the second port. So any intermediate R output goes to the second port. Are you, yes? Right now just R, but Python is, so the question was other languages that are being supported. Right now just R, but we're working on supporting Python. That's the next language. Okay, so I cleaned up my text. Now, when, one more thing before I do that. I'll tell you why I'm doing this. Again, I'm going to take this data and I'm going to split it. Now, this is 1.6 million tweets. Maybe I want to not use all of it to build my model here. Let's say I use 0.5% 0.5 or 50% of it to actually train. But before I do that, let's do this first. Does anyone know what feature hashing means? Okay. Feature hashing is a technique that's often used in text analysis, and what it does is it'll take each of the words and convert it into a hash. So it's, instead of a string, it becomes a numeric value. And what it's trying to do here is it's got, your string could be really, really long and could have a lot of different words. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to map the entire text into a known space. So if I take a 18-digit hash, which is two, I'll have 2 to the power of 18 features, and each of the values in my text, I can take unigram, that is one word at a time, or bigrams, two words, but map that, get a hash and put this in the hash table. So what it's doing is it's creating a table that's a little more manageable, a little more understandable, rather than this endless text. And it's a very common technique used in text analytics for machine learning. So that's sort of what I'm going to do here. I'm going to take the split and I'm going to call it to feature hashing. And this is, first I have to tell it which column I'm going to use for feature hashing. Begin with no columns, include column index 2, because I have 2 columns and the second one was text. Then hashing bit size. This is the space in which, the feature space in which the text will be hashed. If I use 5, it's 2 to the power of 5. That's how many. 2 to the power of 10 means there'll be 1024, 2 to the power of 10 is 1024, that's how many features I will have. 2 to the power of 18, the more you have in terms of power, the less chances of collision. Hashing, everyone knows how hashing works, right? So it's sort of that very thing, but it's trying to take text and map it into this understood feature space so you can work with this. Again, it's a very common machine learning technique for text analytics. If you guys want to read more about it, you can just look up feature hashing. I am going to turn this into 18. The other thing is I was talking about n-grams, right? I want it to take each word at a time. I could specify 2 where it would combine 2 words and take 2 words at a time and create their hash. So you can decide how you want to do this. So once I'm done with this, now I will have 2 to the power 18 features that I'm using to send to my model, send to my model as input. While I'm doing this, by default, all the columns except for target column will be taken as features. I don't want to do that. The text has been mapped into this feature map, so I want the text to no longer be a feature, right? Because I don't want that to be an additional parameter anymore. So I'm going to take this metadata editor, and I'm going to say begin with no columns, include column index 2, because the column index 2 was the one, and it's non-categorical, we'll talk a little bit, but it's clear features, means do not use this column as a feature when sending this data to the model. Once I've done this, then I do my standard train. Score and evaluate. Now pay attention to what I'm doing. I'm going to take this metadata editor and put it before I split, because I know that otherwise when I split, I'll have to do so. This is the typical workflow, right? Train, score, evaluate. From split, you take the second half. But the features have changed. I have turned them in. I've got feature hashing here, so I need to make sure that my test data set also has feature hashing, right? So I need to do that. Now, this is a large data set, so maybe I want to use split again. Now, this is limitation of our system right now, but you can only split into 2. So I'm going to use the, remember this one was 50-50? I'm going to use 0.2% of 50%. And then I'm going to run, because that's what I'm going to use to score the data. I'm training on a larger piece, but I'm scoring on a smaller piece. And I need to do the same thing. metadata editor. But this metadata editor can go up, right? Because I'm clearing the features on all of them, so why don't I put this up? I deleted the wrong one. It goes right up here. So now the metadata editor is just going to take the results from there and clean it up right there. Feature hashing will go here. Feature hashing results will go here. Train model goes here. And sorry?
No, I think you didn't change the second feature hashing.
No, I haven't. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. So support vector machines are actually a really good algorithm to use here. And train model. Column one was, index one was the class of the target column. So just, OK. I have no idea what's going on. OK. That didn't work. Better. And in here, as you said, I haven't changed that. This has to go to 18, and this has to go to 1. And I have to tell it which one I'm using. Start with no column, column name, 2. OK. And then it'll score and evaluate. So before I run any of this, I kind of wanted to make sure everyone understood what is happening here. And then we look at the results. I'm sorry? I did? I'm so sorry. Where? This one?
Yes.
Yes, you're right. It should not be column name. It should be column index. But obviously, when I start try to run it, it'll give me an error. It'll not run. But still, it's good to not waste that time. Questions on what exactly is happening here? What you're doing? Yes.
I just to clarify, so you're using 50% of the data for the learning and 20%.
20% or 50%, which is?
Yeah, so if so you're using 50% for the learning and then 20%
for scoring.
For scoring. So basically the results of that learning is then checked against that 20% to see how accurate it was. Is that? Just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. I can do scoring multiple times. I can score on the data set that I used to learn. I'll show you how. If I try to run this experiment, it's going to take 5 minutes. So I'm not going to run it. I just wanted to show you how to construct it. And then, you know, cooking show style, I'm going to go to the ones that I've already run and show you intermediate results and such. But what happens is, I just wanted to show you that you could have a smaller set of data to score. You did not have to use all of the data that was left over. But you could not do it in a single step. You'd need to actually chain two splits together. That's all I'm trying to demonstrate here. You don't have to do this. Mm-hmm. If you want to use the rest, go ahead and use the rest.
So could you run against 100%?
Yeah. You could. You totally could. There's nothing preventing you from running against 100%. You have to remember, though, I'm doing something very expensive, feature hashing, right? It's taking text, and it's creating this huge matrix of features for me. And if I'm just experimenting with things, trying to figure out how the heck this thing works, I probably don't want to work with a lot of data, because it is proportional to the amount of data it's taking, right? So once I've figured out all my knobs and I'm ready to go run the whole experiment, I will run with larger data. But do these smaller things on smaller subsets of data that kind of give you, say, it's very quick in running. So that's one of the reasons, too.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
Can you convert this model in code?
No. Not
no,
right now.
Because I can write this in R from top to bottom.
I know. You could actually take that pieces of R, embed them in execute R, and it would work just fine.
Yeah, because it's hard to know what you're doing because you have to see in all the cells what is mentioned.
I will show you once it's run. It's actually very easy because you can see the results. This has not been executed, so I can't see any intermediate results. But when it's executed or when it's executing, I can see intermediate results at every step. So it's actually really, really helpful to be able to visualize, to be able to look at that stuff. It's also very easy to look at it at a high level and examine what's going on. When you have a whole block of code, it's kind of hard to debug sometimes because you really have to focus in and look at this. You find problems, oh, look, I did feature hashing here. I forgot to do feature hashing here, or I split, or I didn't. So this is a visual representation. Take it for what it's worth. Okay. And we need to provide a way of encoding this. We're working on that. That will be available, but today it is not. Okay. So.
Is there a way to filter rows? Because if you're looking for sentiment and you have rows with no sentiment in them, it's probably not necessary to use them for training or for scoring. So you would, I guess you would want to filter out those rows without any sentiment, wouldn't you?
So 0 is negative sentiment, 4 is positive sentiment. That was what the labels were.
Okay, but the question still stands. Can you filter out some rows somewhere?
Yeah, you totally could. You could actually say that don't include any of the rows where the column values are X or Y. So if you do, there's a module I can show you. It's called partition and split. Partition and sample. Here, you can actually do stratified sampling where it'll say if you pick true, it'll say which ones do you want to exclude when you're partitioning or splitting the sample data. So you can do exactly what you want. But in this case, I don't want to, so I'm not using it. Any other questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Is there any kind of versioning support for the model so I can go back?
Any kind of versioning support for the model, yes. It is implicit. It is not explicit. So when you create the model and you save it, let me show you. Yes. The answer is yes, but it's not a version number that you can see. You'll have the last version and the latest version. There's only 2 versions.
Only 2. So I cannot experiment and change way back.
So the things I end up doing is, if I like a particular model, I'll save it, and then I'll clone the experiment, run another experiment, and save it as a different name. It's a little, it's not as elegant, but.
Okay.
My question is about the studio, Azure Studio capabilities. Is it possible to collaborate on the studio?
So the way to collaborate in the studio is you would go to settings here, users, and you can invite as many people as you want. Just put your ID there. They'll get an email with a link to your experiment, and they can open up the studio and look at this. They can you can give 2 kinds of permissions, read-only, read-write. Read-only, they can only look at your experiments. They can't run them. Read-write, they can actually author and change your experiments.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's only 7 minutes left, so I'm going to hurry up with the next part, and we can always do question and answers afterwards. Okay, so... Sorry, as you can see, I have a lot of experiments here. So this is basically the same experiment that I just built for you guys, but I've actually run it this time. I've used SVM, train model, score model. Now, there's an interesting thing I'm doing here, which is projecting. So let's take a look at what the score model returns. Remember, the score model returns the sentiment label, the text, which is the 2 features, and this is the feature hash. See how many columns I have here? It only shows 100 first columns, so I'll never see the last 2 columns that got added, which is the score probability and score label. So what I end up doing here is I project these columns out and say, I want the last 2 columns and the first column. And then I run evaluate on that, because evaluate takes the score label, score probability, and the actual answer to give me those pretty graphs. I can also do something like in R, I can use the caret packet to give me the confusion matrix, which is another thing. If you guys are familiar with R, you can do whatever you want here. So this is what it looks like. Not the greatest of accuracy, but it'll do. This is what my text analyzer actually came up with. There's multiple ways that I could go in and tune. I could increase the training sample size. That does help in this case. I could, in the SVM, I change the number of iterations, and I also decrease the learning rate. If you guys are, I'm not going to get into this, but if you have questions about how it impacts the convergence or accuracy of the model, we can talk about that after the talk. So, okay, I'm done with the model building. Say I was very happy with this model. I would go to the train model module and save the train model. And this is where I give it a name and save the train model. Once I've saved the train model, it appears in my palette right here. These are all the different models I've saved over time and built and saved over time. So this is where, when you were asking, can I actually version this, I would create another experiment, create another version, save it. But if I keep changing the same experiment and I save it, it'll say, is this a newer version of the experiment, the model you already have, and it'll replace it in place, which is something you want to do if you want to keep all the other constants the same, right? You figure this out, you just have new data, you want to retrain it or something. That's when you would do the versioning of the same model. But it's your choice. You can have it be the same model, or you could rename it to be something else. Once you are done with this, now you need to score it in. Remember I said you could turn it into a web service? The previous experiment was creation of a model. You would never publish that as a web service. Sometimes people do, and what they're publishing as a web service now is the training of the model, which is a very long-running thing. You don't want to keep, every time someone gives you input data, you don't want to retrain the model. The model is already trained. You take that model, save it off, and create another experiment. Remember, everything is an experiment? You create another experiment, and here is what you create, a scoring graph. The primary thing here is you have the saved model and the score model module. You connect this one to this, and then I have all this happening here, which I can walk through. So I have the full data set. Remember, this kind of gives, and all of this is so that it runs some sort of data transformation on incoming data. I don't need all of this, but if I could have taken this out and taken a small split of data that just had those two columns, I would just say that that's what my input data is going to look like. But I was lazy, and I just said, I'm going to use the initial data set I have. I'm going to split it down to very, very small piece because I don't want to run this experiment for too long. I'm going to project out all the columns except for column 6, which is the text. Remember, that's the input. That's what I'm going to get when I try to do the prediction, right? Then I use the metadata editor, and I change the column name because the initial thing did not have column names, and that was causing problems. I also make sure that I say that this column is not a feature. Please don't use this text as a feature. Then I run the execute R script. This is where things get interesting because this is where I'm transforming the input text into lowercase and making sure that it's only alphanumeric characters. Then I'm doing feature hashing on that, and then I'm passing that to score module. And in the end, I'm projecting out the same columns because I don't want to see the 26,000 different values of various hashes there. So this is the flow. Once I've done this, I need to set up an input and an output port. I usually set up the input port where I start the data transformation. So when the data comes in, what things do I want to go want to have it go through? I want to have it go through the execute R function, so it changes it. One second. It changes it down to lowercase and removes all but the alphanumeric characters. And I want to get a feature hash because that's what I'm going to pass to the model. And then output port is what is the value I want to see. Once I've done this, I run it to validate everything is working, and then I can just press this button here to publish it as a web service. As it happens, I've already published this as a web service. We publish two kinds of web services. We publish a web service that's a request response web service, which is you give it one value, it gives you one answer back, or a batch service, you give it a whole file of values, it returns a file of values back. The API page here for each of these web services gives you the OData endpoint, which can be called from Excel. There's a post URL request header. This is what the JSON request looks like. And there's some sample code here that you can use to directly call this from your environment. So let's test this. I am going to, this is the text which is going to be sent to, and I'm going to do another one. So I have two tests going. One I said this is awesome, the other one I said this is horrible. Let's see what the sentiments are. Positive sentiment would be 4, because that's what our label was, and then negative sentiment would be 0, or close to 0. So this is going to run, it's still running, and now I can answer your question.
Can you have some comments or labels on the boxes there, because you've got metadata something and...
Yeah. Yeah. So you can go into configuration here. You're talking about the experiment?
Yeah, in the experiment.
Okay. So in the experiment here, edit comment.
Okay, perfect.
This is a comment. And by default, it's hidden. You can expand it so that it can show up.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Second question, if I might. At the beginning, you said the cycle is you have some data, you train the model, you publish it, and so on, and then you repeat it when you get the new data. How do you do it?
We are actually working on an API that will allow you to do that in an automated fashion. But right now what you do is you collect the data, you change the data set, the training data set, rerun the experiment, resave the model, and then everywhere after that, once you resave the model, it'll say there's a new version available. Do you want to switch for staging and for production? So
for now it's manual?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Once you change the data set and rerun the experiment, you will be prompted that there's a newer version you want to save.
Okay.
And you can go from there.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, I'm out of time, so I'm hoping these are done and then we can get... So, can anyone see these? So, the result for this is awesome is 4 with a probability, with the score probability of 0.8. Can you guys see this at all? Okay. And the details for this is horrible is 0 with a probability of 0.13. So it at the first blush, it seems to be okay. I've tested it with some of the other things I have. I was hoping to do some more fun things, but I've run out of time. So thank you so much for listening.